20th anniversary of Archive, I think it's most fitting to have a presentation by Paul Genscart, the man behind the throne, behind the screen, for the Eastman Archive, which today, I checked today, and there's over 702,000 open access articles in a range of subject areas. It's no exaggeration to say that Archive revolutionized scholarly communication in the sciences, not just in the academy or North America, but everywhere. And it engages scientists across a broad spectrum, from the most senior faculty member to independent researchers in remote areas of the world. Recently, I was talking with a very talented young physicist from Yale University, who, when she heard I was from Cornell, praised us for maintaining her library. We collectively owe a great deal to Paul for his inspiration, his persistence, and his commitment. Indeed, when he was named a MacArthur Fellow, the foundation stated that, quote, Genscart has deliberately transformed the way physics gets challenging conventional standards for review and communication of research, and thereby changing the speed of and mode of dissemination for scientific advances. Paul received his BA in physics at Harvard in 1977 and then came to Cornell, where he was granted a doctorate in theoretical particle physics in 1981. He then returned to Cambridge to the Society of Fellows and in 1984 became a faculty member in the physics department at Harvard. In 1990, Paul moved to the theoretical division of Los Alamos National Lab, and the following year he started eprint archives. And in 2001, he returned to Cornell as a professor of physics and computing and information science, bringing the decade-old archive with him. Paul has served on many committees, including the U.S. National Committee for CoData, other NRC, NIS, AAAS committees, NIH PubMed Central National Advisory Board, the American Physical Society Publications Oversight Committee, the Public Library of Science, and Fedora Commons Advisory Boards, and on the faculty advisory boards for both the Cornell University Library and Cornell Information Technology. I was most disappointed that Paul did not wear his bike helmet this afternoon, because he usually arrived at the library advisory board with it on and often left it on. In addition to the MacArthur Award, Paul has received many other awards, including the Physics Astronomy Math Award from the Special Libraries Association. He's a fellow of the American Physical Society. In 2005, he received the Council of Science Editors Award for Meritorious Achievement. In 2006, he was named the Paul Evans, received the Paul Evans Peters Award from EDUCAUSE, ARL, and CNI. And in 2008, he was named a Radcliffe Institute Fellow. So please join me in welcoming Paul.
So yeah, I apologize for the lack of bicycle helmet. The reason is that my office is in this building, so I just had to. So it's nice to see all the usual blank faces in the front row. I know them well from the classes I teach here. I don't, what? So I left in this second half of the abstract here something that I meant to take seriously, that a lot of the questions here, this is now a user-dominated resource, so a lot of the questions here I'll leave open to the audience. I've tried very hard to pare down. Usually these talks run for an hour, and this is only supposed to be a half hour, so I've tried to be very diligent and pare down the transparencies just to the essential ones, namely the ones that serve as setups for punchlines. So to begin with, since this is being hosted very kindly by the library, by way of background, I'd like to give you my first experience in a university library. I was a high school student from Long Island going to a summer program at Columbia University on math and computers. And I happened to walk over to the Columbia campus, to this building that said the Library of Columbia University, and walked in, and there were no books. And I didn't realize at the time, this would have been 1971, that this was the library of the future. Some of you may, I was curious enough to investigate further and was told that, in fact, it had been changed to an administrative building many years before, but it was hard to erase this because it was etched into the portico. So, okay. So I'm going to cut short my personal history just to say a few things. As Anne mentioned, I moved to Los Alamos, from Harvard to Los Alamos in 1991, take advantage of the fact that the almanac, the World Almanac, claimed 300 sunny days a year in Albuquerque as compared to 60 sunny days per year in Cambridge. And then after a while discovered that it's very unnerving when it doesn't rain for 9 months, and returned here 10 years ago. I mentioned this 1971. This was my own history spans, as will no longer be the case for succeeding generations. I haven't seen everything. There are people here who've seen more than me, but I started in high school working with 100 blood teletype, and I've seen IBM key punches. In 1973, I started doing email with my brother over the old ARPANET. This is usually the setup for a joke, which is that my undergraduate class, since it included Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates, has the largest average net worth of any undergraduate class ever. But you know, I'm now looking sort of nervously at the class of 2006. And that's not the only reason I'm not thrilled with Facebook. So Thelma Ray typed my thesis here. This is probably the last generation of people over in Newman Lab. And then we moved into the tech and the network era. During the period I was here as a graduate student, Peter LePage arrived as a postdoc. Not dressed like that. Okay, so this is just a fond recollection. I was working on this at Aspen. I was a summer visitor at Aspen that summer, and it was a serendipitous comment. We were talking about how we could improve the way physics resources were sent around. It was purely an email era. This is what I mainly want to highlight here, how much different the landscape was 20 years ago. It's hard even to recall in an era where now we're walking around with our smartphones and all of the rest. In Aspen at the time, the only way to communicate to the exterior was a single satellite building where there were three terminals and modems. So I have an email. This date was doctored for the purposes of a talk I gave there a couple of months ago. So this is an email that I sent, which was fun for the purpose of that talk. I dug this up. I happen to have, incidentally, every email I've sent or received since the early 1980s, which is one reason if I find out I have some fatal disease, the first thing I'll do is erase all of my disk. And so here you can see I was asking, and there's a point to this slide. Back in 1991, I went over to this terminal modem, and I sent a message to the people who handle the top-level accounts. I wanted to get an email address for hepth@lanl.gov. And the answer came back from somebody whose name I've omitted, that providing aliases for non-paying customers is not a service that we provide. There's no free lunch. If you want a .forward, incidentally misspelled, you need to have a home directory. If you have one, you have to have a password and all that. This is a service organization. We are required to pay for things. In order to do that, we must pass the cost on to the people requesting the service. Don't you think that is fair? And I was entertained reading this because this is essentially what the library now says in the archive support and sustenance long-term, trying to extract money from all of the people requesting the service. And then the other thing I discovered by dredging this up is for many years I would always send arbitrarily rude messages and end them, thank you for your interest, and this is where I acquired that habit. Okay, this is just a picture of an actual picture of the machine. Presumably, Mark, was this the machine we were using when you were there?
Yeah,
so this is not a doctored photograph. This is a desk, and it's just a machine sitting on the floor. The office was not intentionally put in disarray for the purposes of this photograph, nor even was this book, which looks like it's carefully, it is a book entitled Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. As far as I know, this empty can of Coke is still sitting on that desk 20 years later. So, this is the, it started during this early period as a pure email repository, and this is the canonical graph we always show. There's no talk about the subject would be complete without this, without mentioning this mysterious linear increase in the number of submissions per month. It wasn't intended to be anything visionary, even the numbering scheme. The first entry was labeled 9108001, and the reason was everything was going to be deleted after 3 months. I was just going to put in a cron tab, and then the ordinary paper distribution system would catch up. But what happened was it really caught on from day one. I guess maybe this could be lower. It started receiving email submissions from day one and never stopped. And what you're seeing here in this, I'll partition this out into different subject areas in a moment, but what you're seeing is sort of the confluence of different subject areas coming in and turning on, and the original one, the high energy physics, where it started, saturated relatively quickly. One of the points that I did want to emphasize right from the outset is I heard frequently during this period how democratic the system was, that what a boon it was for researchers in developing countries. That came automatically. What I was trying to do was set up a system that eliminated the hierarchy in our own research area. There were some intrinsic unfairnesses, that is, some of us at the time, having been a faculty member at Harvard, I was receiving preprints before, say, the graduate students and people lower down on the food chain who depended on us for feeding information to them. And that struck us as intrinsically unfair. When we make some important advance, we like to think it's because we worked harder or we had more inspiration. We don't like to think it's because we had advanced access to privileged information. So I was trying to solve that problem, but automatically we were very, very fortunate that this period was right at the cutting edge of the new technology. Everybody was turning on. It was just before the World Wide Web and all of the rest. And so we were able to dovetail with all of the simultaneous developments in popular technology and produce something which still to this day, when I posted an article with a retrospective a month ago, I still received messages from Argentina, former Soviet Union, of people saying, you forgot to emphasize that it was not only important to us then, it remains important to us now. So this is what the interface looks like. I usually introduce this in the glass half empty, glass half full metaphor. The half full metaphor is it's the same page, roughly speaking, as 10 to 15 years ago. It's not exactly. This is a screen grab from a few years ago. But morally speaking, it's the same. And you could say, wow, how unbelievably visionary that this entire apparatus that was put in place 20 years ago has scaled to accommodate all of the activity. And not only that, some of the software written 20 years ago is still running the site. That's absolutely amazing. How many sites do you know that are running on 20-year-old software? And that, of course, brings up the glass half-empty point of view, which is, how many sites do you know are running 20-year-old software? And it's not all 20 years old, but there are there is a constant need, and that's also underlying this 20th anniversary and the questions of sustainability. And what I meant by the price for success, if this thing had gone the way that was originally intended, that it was some transitional phase where eventually we moved into a new system where it was no longer necessary, we wouldn't now be faced with this question. You have a successful resource, how do you fund it for the long term, make it a sustainable operation? The issue for the library is we have lots of vocal physicists who say, how could you even question whether or not you should be supporting it, because this is the most actively used resource of the entire library, and the library can quite reasonably respond. That's all well and good, but our primary mandate is to serve the local community, and the vast majority of the benefits in this case are accrued by the exterior, and that argues for, if it is a resource that the library can get exterior funding for, especially in these difficult, or at least more difficult, economic times. This building, incidentally, was designed in quite clearly times that were less economically stressed. And the library should certainly extract money wherever it can. So this is the just a quick overall overview where, as Ann mentioned, we're in the range of 700,000 documents. We're growing at 75,000 a year, so we would expect about 725,000. If we continue by the end of this calendar year, if we continue at this linear rate, that would be 1.5 million at the end of 2020. It makes a very popular proving ground for network-related research using either the citation tree, the co-author network. We've been using it in collaboration with the information science and CS departments for a variety of text mining exercises and all the rest. 400,000 distinct users per week. We've also got, I'll talk a little about this, the interaction with the general public via the trackback and other mechanisms, and this is my reason for moving back here. So there are a few things about it mentioned quickly on one page. It's all taken for granted, but remember, this started before the web, before people were taking it for granted that journals would all go online and our lives would move online and we'd all be, some of us at least, would be logging into social networks every day. Some of the things that we pioneered were using the abstract page as a hub. This thing migrated to the web as soon as we weren't the first website, that was the Slack library set up, but I was in constant communication with them and very soon set up our own website and linking author names via the search index. We used PostScript, compressed, and later PDF as a network transmission format, and that's ironic because that's now a ball and chain dragging us down. I say it foreshadowed Web 2.0 in the sense, insofar as Web 2.0 describes some skeletal structure into which users deposit content, and it increases in value because it's shareable and reusable. That was not only essentially what we were doing, but that's what every academic journal does. This is just the broad scale where it fits in. Oldenburg, the Philosophic Transactions of the Royal Society, was nominally the first journal, 1665. Number of publications here. This is a log scale. This graph was provided to me by Cadi Borner from Indiana, and I provided the data on archive so you can see where we are in the overall scheme of things. Not a dominant fraction of the world's academic publication, but a non-negligible fraction. And she stuck in here Wikipedia, which is comparing apples and oranges, but that one is increasing even more quickly. This is a survey that I promised separated out by subject area. The purple here, okay. So the purple here is the original high energy physics, and this is this effect that by the within 10 years we had essentially saturated, and now we just see these sort of Poisson fluctuations around some mean. And it wasn't that people were writing more articles during this period. This just represents the fraction of the community participation, and by 2000 we had 100% participation. And I use this slide to point out there were people in 1992 who said, say, with respect to astronomy, that's the red, that, aha, this system is all well and good for the high energy physicists who are only interested in the research of the last 10 or 20 nanoseconds, but it will never be adopted by a serious field such as astrophysics or condensed matter, or take your pick. And it's useful to have this historical retrospective because, of course, you see the red for astrophysics climbing, 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 and eventually it surpasses, as does the green for condensed matter. And more recently, a similar question has been raised with respect to computer science. That's this odd, dull yellow color. And it looks like it's going nowhere, and then it just suddenly starts shooting up. And I could discuss later why it was sort of the confluence of Google and Sightseer that were promoting the web harvesting during this days, which delayed their adoption. And this is a graph, the previous graph and this one, Simeon Warner made for me, and the library's been using, which is just showing clearly scaling everything to one. And so you can see, of course, in 1992, it's 100% high energy physics, and you can see how that fraction has been continuously diminishing. And there's no one dominant one. It's math, if anything, is the one that's been growing fastest. But since this whole thing is growing, anything that manages to keep its overall fraction is doing extremely well. This is a usage plot for the main site. This was part of an assessment exercise when I arrived here. I did it shortly after I arrived. What is the continuing utility of this resource? So the question is, we started in 1991. That was before anything was online. Everybody used it because that was the only thing around. By the mid-1990s, all of the journals had started coming online. And so is this resource now redundant, obsolete? We don't need it anymore. And the answer that you get looking at the increased usage is not only that it's popular, it's more popular than ever because of the even though there were different types of availability, there were more people and more actively using resources like this. This dip, of course, is the back then people had trouble getting online from Christmas to New Year's. And this is an update. Somebody asked at the meeting a day or two ago how much of our traffic comes. These are the full text downloads. This black is the Google referrals. We permitted them to index starting in early 2002, and it looks like roughly half the half of our full text referrals are coming by people searching for Google, except of course when the Google index breaks, and well, I shouldn't have said except, including of course when the Google index breaks, and you know, so our activity levels are down, and you wonder, it's not that Google itself was broken, it just was that they weren't referring people to us, and who knows what they were finding instead for these searches. You see, it's, you know, again, very regular. You see the spiky activity. I'll mention in a moment, we have, by complete coincidence, a gigantic spike today. Simeon tells me already more than 140,000 people, and so that's a gigantic spike like this because of this press release from CERN yesterday or last night and a seminar they gave today about neutrinos traveling faster than the speed of light. And so this is all very popular in the news. It fits into this rollover Einstein meme. You know, since traveling faster than the speed of light would violate causality, I'm willing to violate causality as well and assert with complete confidence that this result won't stand up. So here's an example, actually, of this kind of interaction with the popular press. And I think I have, so this is one that I used a little while ago. I used this one in Aspen. This was about some of these anomalies, possibly finding Higgs boson or something like that at CERN. Let me deviate for a moment and see if I've got here. Yeah, so here's the one I just mentioned. Measurements of the neutrino velocity with OPERA detector, and all of these, you look at the dates, all of these trackbacks were harvested last night. And this is getting this giant amount. And somewhere here, the New York Times, tiny neutrinos may have broken the speed of light. Ah, and so there really is a rollover Einstein. The other popular memes are, I pulled this one up. This one I like, it's by locals. Most of you probably know Alexander Gaeta and his group, who had a demonstration of temporal cloaking. And here it falls into the Harry Potter meme. This was an interesting one. Alex asked me about this because he posted this paper on archive. It was picked up. He's submitting it to Nature. It was picked up by blogs. And the blogs included one of his figures, which were then reproduced in an article in Science about his submission to Nature, which was under embargo. Here's another one. This is from a couple of weeks ago. Transiting circumbinary planet, actually just a week ago. And so this is the one where it's a planet going around a double star. So that, of course, is Tatooine. Fits into the Star Wars meme. So, you know, the moral of the story is go for the movie tie-ins. That's where the publicity is. Okay. Speaking of causality violation, so somebody already has a response to the, you know, this is the papers being produced at the speed of light. Very recently, BBC Nature reported some puzzling results obtained at CERN. It's been moved to Gen PH already? Okay. All right.
Under embargo.
Okay, so we don't usually publicize usage data. I just wanted to, I always include this one because I'm so proud of it. These are some lectures that I gave at Lesueux on conformal field theory back in 1988. And I did not post them. 2003, Csaba Csaki asked me, why aren't those online? And I told him because I told him something that was factually quite correct, that in 1991, 1988 seemed like ancient history. But in 2003, that argument no longer seemed as compelling. And I just inserted it without an announcement. Actually, I inserted it in a way that violates all library standards, which was I backdated it to 1991 as though it were the last submission in August 1991. And without any, without saying anything about it, presumably via Google search, you see it just picks up. And you know, so in the course of this time, it's been downloaded over 20,000 times. And I also use this, though, to indicate to you the dangers of using. There are lots of things that readership activity are useful for, but if you do a calculation, what you find is that if somebody were to set up a little process doing via anonymous proxies and you grab something seven times a day, that's 50 times a week, which is about 2,500 times a year, which is roughly what this corresponds to. And so if you're rewarding people for the number of reads rather than the number of citations, then it's incredibly easy to game. And I can also say, though, by contrast, during this period when it received actually now much more than 20,000 reads, it has not received a single citation. This is a more recent one. This is the article I mentioned just about this 20th anniversary stuff, just to show you what a typical, well, this is a little atypical, but just to give a feeling for the structure and this readership data. Big spike early on, a few thousand people read it. It tails off, and then readership per day, and then 30 days later, I replaced it, and replacing also gives you a big bump, an extra advertisement, people see it. So what are some of the surprises? I've now talked for about 25 minutes, but I want to say a few things that we've learned. One is, in the broader sense, a great surprise about the power of crowdsourcing, not only in our academic community, but in the broader community. Things like Wikipedia, 2007, the concern was how could something like that work? And increasingly, we are using that, using references to Wikipedia articles that we check out, even in our teaching. You know, the Facebook, the need for these social interactions is such that a mediocre user interface and a privacy-violating financial model are not a hindrance to getting 750 million users or whatever it is. Another surprise I foreshadowed, we're still using tech. This is quite odd. It's a very slow move. Tech, of course, was the encyclopedic demolition of the problem of print on paper. And we were, in effect, abusing it as a network transmission format. It was never intended for that. And you know, the fact that it's really a page markup language hinders us in a variety of ways. But we don't have something that's better in all respects. Another surprise to me was I'd written 15 years ago, just an indication I get all of these things wrong. I would have claimed that something like Google couldn't possibly work, you know, once there were enough materials online. And this is another one where I just said, that we're in a metastable state of researchers posting open access articles simultaneously sending to journals to have the material certified. Libraries are still paying journal subscriptions. Something is a mismatch there. Eventually, people are going to stop insisting that the libraries pay for the journal subscriptions because they're no longer reading the material from the journals. They're getting it from archive, and felt that that situation couldn't persist for another 5 years, but that was 15 years ago. So coupled to that is that there's still, after all this time, no real consensus on the best way to implement quality control, how we should configure scholarly communications, how we should fund it. When implementing quality control, should it be top-down or bottom-up? When to do it, before general dissemination, after general dissemination? All of these remain open questions. How to integrate data, other tools needed for scientific reproducibility. And coupled to some of these questions of the financial model for scholarly communications is just a gigantic surprise when you think about it. We have all of these capabilities, but it was never obvious that it was going to use the same financial model as commercial television from the 1960s, which is everything's funded by putting advertisements in front of eyeballs. Okay, this is just an example. I won't spend much time on this. If one moves away, this was similar things were shown in the publisher meeting a couple of days ago. If we move away from tech, then you can do this in PDF, but it's sort of turning it upside down. You can start mining the text, finding either institutions, coloring them different and automatically linking, or doing nice things that are always a problem. In PDF, I need two copies of it open and so two different windows so I can look up references. But here you have things like mousing over, being able to see references, or nice interfaces where the references are on the right side. But now I just wanted, I've now gone for 30 minutes. Just to say a few things about what it is that we do, which is also something of a surprise. An increasing amount of the effort on a daily basis is spent what we would call guarding the perimeter. The fundamental tension is that the resource is out there, it looks open, but it was never intended as a means for outsiders to broadcast into the community. It was always intended as a means for professional researchers to communicate to one another. And on the other hand, there are many more non-researchers on the internet than researchers. And many of them, not having the same training as researchers, have different standards for what constitutes not only research, but interesting and correct. So we have, you know, over time developed an increasingly elaborate model of things being sent out to many of whom are here as part of the scientific advisory board, people who both look at submissions and pass them around, not to do conventional refereeing, it's a slightly different model, but just to give it what we call the one look approximation, which is it science and is it appropriate to the subject area? And what it's meant was, I'm always reminded of a comment by Eugene Garfield, who started the Science Citation Index, who told me that he just started it because he wanted the data. He wanted to track citations. But he found out that you always have to draw a line. Which journals are you going to include in this? You need above some quality level. Otherwise, you're getting noise in your data. And so once the resource became more generally used, inevitably, he went down the slippery slope of becoming an accrediting agency. And we're on an even stranger slope where we're not accrediting individual papers. Ultimately, what we're doing is career review of people and deciding that, you know, certain people are part of the community or not. So it's a difficult game. Because I've run short on time, I don't have that many more slides, but I had a lot of things to say about them. Let me just mention very briefly, we do a lot of text mining. One of the a fun observation that I made was I did a very primitive, sort of naive Bayes-like classifier to find subject areas. And then every once in a while, it spits something out as unclassifiable, and you eyeball it, and it's basically a crackpot filter, because, you know, the people who are coming from outside of the community are using a language that's essentially sitting in some orthogonal subspace in this vector space model. And so, you know, coupled to this is, in an imaginary world where something like archive predated the conventional journals, peer-reviewed and all of the rest, I mentioned this question of what would we have nonetheless been forced to invent them, just not, you know, for the full-fledged peer review and for grant allocation and all of the rest, but just to filter out, you know, that subset of people who, for whom we really have no response. When they want to know why was this submission not appropriate, you can't use ordinary conventions of logic. Another thing I was going to say about, which we'll talk a little more about, and I have a slide on this, is this was something that Simeon and I did with CS graduate student Johannes Gerke in the CS department about 5 years ago, which was software to analyze, not really plagiarism in the general sense, but just text overlap. It was quite fascinating to me that you could take a database of what's now 700,000 articles, fingerprint it, fit it all in 12 gigabytes of RAM, and do instant lookups so you could find on the stream of incoming submissions any, say, 7 words that appeared anywhere else in the database. And we were slow to finish it back then because the results, frankly, were too horrifying to contemplate. That we weren't set up to be an international policing organization. And this slide is a little difficult to parse, but I'll try to walk you through it. So anyway, I picked it up again because I had a very good student in Info 4300 who wanted to do a master's project last spring. And so, and unlike the No. He was a native speaker of English. And so he was appropriate for this project because it just involves some subtleties there. And so what we're looking for is, what we're looking at is on the horizontal, this is just 7 grams. So this is the number of 7 grams. And on the vertical, they're both log scale, is the number of article pairs that have that number of coincident 7 grams. And so, you know, small number here, 10, there are, and the red, green, and the blue are roughly the 3 levels of severity. So the green is if 2 articles contain that many, but at least one author is in common. Sorry, that's the red. The green is there are no authors in common, but at least they had the common decency to cite their source. And the blue is when the text overlap occurs and there's not even a citation. This is everything. This is the roughly 700,000 articles. And so, you know, what you have here is, you know, over here, the many hundreds, thousands of articles that have, you know, 1,000 overlapping 7-word windows. These are the people who just every single paper they write is using the previous one as a template. And so it's 75 to 80% identical. They change one equation and publish it. The one is in the Chinese Journal of Physics, the next one is in the Czech Journal of Physics, the next one's in the Canadian Journal of Physics. I apologize if I'm insulting anyone's region of origin. And these citation ones, and so here you see we're in the many hundreds of 7 grams, and they've cited it, and this contains everything from the graduate student thesis that says the following introductory material is adapted from X, and the next 27 pages verbatim are taken from summer lecture notes on subject. Yes, I'm not making this up. Or the cases where the article is essentially, this is as remarkable as anything, the article is stitched together paragraph by paragraph from independent sources and gets published. You know, the really bad ones are, you know, this is a log graph, but I didn't do log binning. And, you know, you see lots of these because they're just individual numbers. These should just all be grouped together in some range. But, you know, you can see the many thousands of things that we're dealing with here. And then the blue, of course, is, you know, the people who are borrowing, you know, 25 to 70% of their article from another source and not even citing it. And, you know, you have to stop and think how extraordinary it is. It's not, you know, maybe having the papers available in electronic form facilitates it, but let's be serious, it also facilitates detection. And once you're detected, it's unambiguous. So it's a complete mystery to me why this is the case. But we had to do this exercise to understand the background that we're working in. Your first temptation is, you know, any overlap that can't possibly be good, but now we know what the background is, and so it's like doing a high-energy experiment. You're just looking for signal above the background. This screens, by the way, common phrases like, you know, this article is organized as follows, which appears in 20,000 articles by different authors. But those are easy to, if they're above some threshold, then it's easy to screen that. So I've essentially exhausted my time. I will collapse what I was going to say. I had some reflections on what we do now that's so different from 20 years ago, particularly in teaching, the way we have readily available via the web all of these 30 third-party notes, microblog seminars, video feeds. This will be on the net, you know, the wiki in my course. I'm now implementing Piazza so that the students can ask one another questions. A ramped up form of wiki for notes. Coupled with that are all of these new expectations that it used to be that we were willing to get out of our office, walk from here over to, say, Olin Library to look up some resource, come back, 15 minutes to half an hour, and now how many of us get frustrated if we can't get exactly the resource we want within 5 seconds? And so the expectations are ramped up. We're dealing with a new generation of users that's been living with this expectation in what we could call the Google era of arbitrarily available information and in the commerce era of being able to order anything you want. And so we have to think about that. It's an interesting challenge to see how to configure things for a generation that comes at all of this from a different point of view. One of the other things that comes to mind, I forgot about this slide, is we're seeing right now in the popular news this face-off, if you like, between Google and Facebook. Underlying this is the tension of which is the optimal refer mechanism. Do we like to access information directly via what we would call the information layer, the methodology perfected by Google, or not perfected, but promoted and employed, or the social layer, the point of view that Facebook took of having users just recommend information. Of course, somebody has to have access to a raw information feed, or nobody learns anything new. And we always get questions, and we probably will. We're experimenting with recommendation systems right now, but you know, just want to make the point that an imperfect filter could be worse than none. And there's this irony that a system that increases diversity at the personal viewpoint, that is, every individual is reading more than they would have otherwise, can have the paradoxical effect of decreasing the global diversity. If you like, everybody is broadened, but they're all broadened in exactly the same direction. And that's the problem you have specifically with recommendation systems that just put up the most popular articles. Everybody reads the same thing. And we're working on much more personalized systems that can do a topic analysis of the text of the articles. Users inherit their topic interest from the articles they read. It knows what articles they read. And you know, the way to assess these systems is a little difficult. My proposal was to take two groups of graduate students, give one system, give the other another system, and then follow them over the course of 2 decades and see which one gets the better jobs, the better grants, and all of the rest. But NSF balked at using, you know, people for experiments, so I said, well, we can do it with mice. And the grant proposal, I think, was of mice and men. But so there are ways of doing it. I'm essentially effectively out of time here. See, these aren't numbered, so I forgot. Okay, nobody's left. You know, coupled with this question of of diversity and recommender systems, the reason I'm very uneasy about them is because this is another unexpected effect that that somebody pointed out to us, and then with a graduate student in CS, I investigated a little further. This is a graph, and it's the same graph. If this is for astrophysics, this is the graph for HepTH. This is the graph for HepPH. You see all of them have this strange anomalous spike occurring at around 4 o'clock. And what's happening there is that's the turnover. 4 o'clock every day is when the system freezes the submissions for the day, and those are the ones that are going to be released at night. And after 4 o'clock is when the new submissions come in, and they're announced in order. Historically, they've been announced in order. And so what this is people aiming for the pole position. That is, they're just sitting there, and you know, we see them in the web log. We have something that gives the time, and you know, starting at 13:59:30, they're just pushing the button every 3 seconds. You think they could synchronize their clock once and for all, and then as soon as it goes 16, it's this reaction game like they have at the Science Center where you've just got to, you know. And the question that was posed was, does it work? Not in the sense of, yeah, I mean, our system is deterministic, but does it give you any advantage? And the surprising answer was, yes, there's a very significant effect that even using a subset of articles that would have appeared somewhere in the middle and it were instead switched right to the beginning, even though it's only a one-day effect on the day it's announced, there's still a measurable trace in the citation record 6 years later that the articles that appear higher up in the listings get more citations, and it's a vexing result. There's one quite amusing aspect to this, which is in HEPTH, the high energy physics theory, there's this sub hump that occurs just before. And these are not people who are premature submitters, you know, trigger finger. These are what we call procrastinators, you know, who are just trying to beat the deadline. And in HEPTH, these are the ones who get the most citations. You can find them, and you know, so that's, again, not surprising, the people who are busy, who don't get around to things late in the day. The other thing you find, though, since we had to screen for various geographic effects, is that if you submit in the middle of the day, independent of headlines, that strongly correlates with fewer citations. So that means that, again, something that we might have guessed, that you know, if all else being equal, if you're oblivious to deadlines, you're not being very creative. So now, one of the things, this is something that you can actually tune, and I have no time to talk about it at all, but it raises the question, and I did a follow-up, that what about effects of serendipity? What if you happen, through no fault or foresight of your own, to submit an article on the same day that an article that will ultimately be highly cited? Do you get a coattail effect or an anti-coattail effect? Or similarly, what happens, again, through no design or fault of your own, you happen to submit on a day that has a large number of articles. You don't know in advance if it's going to be big or if it's going to be small. And you know, one answer is, if you get lucky and submit on a day with a small number of articles, and we have big enough samples to make all of these things statistically significant, you'll get more citations. But you can't translate that into, you know, this you can try to, you know, translate into some methodology, but that's a little more well, you know, if you could get historical data and find out which days are likely to be slow, build a model, then you could possibly do it. Why do these things happen? Just one comment, but an important comment. Things like this can happen and show a trace in the citation record because it's never before been the case that you have a global system where everybody in a research community accesses, in a global research community, accesses the same information in the same order from the same system. So what I call this global resonance. And you know, and it suggests an easy way around it. That's why we're looking at some of these recommender systems. So everybody sees something customized and personalized, and that is a better solution than just randomizing, which I can explain later on. The readership is very predictive. Statistically, you can tell. That's why I had that first graph in there showing that early spike. We've analyzed, and from the nature of those spikes, you can you know, basically at 95% confidence level, know how many citations the thing is going to get 5 or 6 years later. It's surprising. Well, it's not too surprising, but it just means that, you know, it's not surprising that citations follow from readership. It's perhaps more surprising that readership so closely tracks the ultimate quality that people can tell on the basis of title, author, and abstract, whether this is going to be hot or interesting. Okay, so this is the last slide, and I just put this up. There are a bunch of questions that have been plaguing us for a while. Most of them I've already discussed. The financial model, how the pieces of this gigantic network, I've been focused on archive. I haven't tried to place any of the work we've talked about of putting it in the broader context. And, you know, in particular, something that's come up a few times at the meeting we've been at is questions of semantic enhancement. You know, how you mark up articles so they're not in this generic PDF format intended for printers, but ways of linking information. We've had, I wanted to mention, you know, intriguingly, we now have implementations such as Watson, which won this Jeopardy challenge. And what that is telling us is that the algorithms and the computing power are now such that we can have automated means of emulating what used to be quintessentially human properties. And we could imagine automate, you know, it wouldn't be, you might say, okay, they've solved the problem of finding the question, so I say, the gauge theory of the weak and electromagnetic interaction, and it comes back and says, what is SU2 cross U1? But eventually they'll also solve the answer from the question, and we'll have a useful way of navigating all of these resources. And the goal that we're all working on, and I don't know if I have ideas for doing this, and part of the idea behind Archive and pushing it is that some of these things wouldn't happen autonomously, but it becomes a platform for experimentation and maybe pushing the envelope, because you know what we want as researchers or students is some, instead of this keyword search and all of these primitive tools, we'd like something that pre-synthesizes the concepts, allows us to navigate directly, clean it from redundancy and ambiguity, authenticate it, highlight it for novelty, and all of the rest. So since I'm less involved in the administration, I may have more to say about this on the 10-year time frame. And that's it. Isn't here, but I am perfectly happy to entertain questions. Yes?
So what is the simple objection to pure randomization?
Good question. the answer may seem obscure to you. So I posed this to Michael Kurtz. It's really his observation that if you make a change, you want to make sure it's better for everyone. And the people we're dealing with in this case are both the authors and the readers. And who are we benefiting if we just randomize? Well, there are some people in the middle who weren't getting an equitable reading. But I didn't go into great detail. It turns out that a lot of those articles would have been highly cited anyway, even though they were in the first position. So let me just, because this is necessary for the answer. So the ones that are appearing in the first position are not a random subset in the first place. You've got people who think they have something hot, so they're putting it there, or they're big research groups, and they have a graduate student to assign to the task. That means, you know, more funding. People with more funding have a past record. And so you expect those to get more anyway. And the readers are trained to look for these. And so if you randomized, you'd actually be doing a significant disservice to the readers who have been benefiting from the people correctly putting the articles that will be cited high in the beginning of the list. And you know that's why randomizing it would, it's not even clear who exactly would help. It would be fairer, but you'd actually be doing a disservice to some of the readers. Now, the way you know, we know, we have random subsets of articles that were moved in to fill places, and those are the ones that we use. You know, one is a self-promotion effect, which is well known, and you know, was some absolutely astounding. Those get close to a factor of two more citations that appear in the first position. But we're more interested in this pure visibility effect, the ones where the submitter hadn't tried to do anything, all else being equal, would have landed in the middle, but it was shifted to the beginning by administrative action to fill a hole. Those get as much as a 50% boost in median citation 6 years ago. And that's the really astounding one. Anyone else? Yes?
I want to ask about this issue of community policing and finding which is the question of how we, what tools does this give us for helping define what the community of science is? Because you're talking as though there's a clear professional community. And of course, one of the questions that those of us who study history and sociology of science is saying, well, those boundaries are not always clear. And in fact, that's often where the contestation is who gets to count as professional or not. And so to the extent that you've had, you know, I know some of the rules you've had to institute, but are there actually tools that you think of to use this to investigate that question of what the boundaries are and how the boundaries are constructed?
I don't have a strong answer to that. It's the essential question. I've had a long email discussion with Harry Collins on exactly that point, a sociologist of science who thinks about different types of knowledge and how they're employed. And he in particular poses as a general relativist and can convince people he's actually a physicist rather than a sociologist. It's a frustrating thing. All I can say is it's a set of ad hoc heuristics, and it's something that's simultaneously vexing and satisfying to me that all of this time I've been able to say, this is junk, maybe this isn't. And that's the final word.
Ultimately down to some small set, whatever the set of people is.
I don't like the person's name, that's the end of it. A little more seriously, there are automated tools one can use. It's not just me, of course. I'm exaggerating this. This goes through the moderator system. It goes through but it's a very small set of people. And the intuition they use is, does this person have a conventional publication record? Does this person have an institutional affiliation? And there are always caveats about that, because there's a class of material produced by people who were formerly legitimate, retain their institutional affiliation, but can no longer connect nouns and verbs into coherent sentences. And putting out streams of the same sort of Einstein is wrong, general relativity is wrong. In general, we also have tools. There are, I didn't mention this, but it's not random stuff that we get from the non-scientists. They cluster very strongly depending on the subject area. In mathematics, it's proofs of the Riemann hypothesis, new proofs of Fermat's last theorem, new proofs of the non-involving computers of the four-color theorem. So it's very popular things, and you can easily flag those. Those are a set of tools. I mean, they're not interested in, you won't get a crackpot paper on calculating some cohomology class of a complex projective manifold. That just doesn't happen. And in physics, it's more, roll over Einstein, quantum mechanics is wrong, that sort of thing. And in computer science, it's just overwhelmingly P is equal to NP, P is not equal to NP. It's people successively proving both and not really acknowledging the contradiction. I'd say the strongest indication is the social network. And there, the historical examples we know we have to we have to be concerned about is, after all, there was a Ramanujan. And the one that usually comes up from these, so you're looking for features to flag these people. One of my favorites is, as soon as the person says, ahem, what if I were a patent examiner at Bern, end of discussion. Any others? Yeah.
Regarding the question of policing, regarding the perimeter, crowdsource that problem and let the people in the blogs or people in some sort of other format deal with this issue of trying to promote the good ones and keep out the junk ones? And either do that on your own, on the archive, and have that system make away with it, or just let it be its own entity.
Yeah. So that as well is I'm glad you made that point, because it permits me to say something else that I forgot to mention. It's because of, in part, we have to be careful with it because of this interplay with the popular media that we've already seen. You know, we've got an article there. It's been downloaded by 150,000 people. That's part of why. So these things are going up with Cornell's imprimatur. And we're sort of sensitive. Sarah Thomas, the previous university librarian, I believe composed that statement about how the holding should be consistent with Cornell academic principles, or maybe it was Tom. And I think that's a good principle, that we've got a university resource that's supposed to be serving the community. And your question is embedded in the question I raised. Do you want to do top-down quality control or bottom-up? And that's the bottom-up point of view. And it's very, very attractive. But for this question, we've got the creationist or, you know, something that's medically dangerous and all the rest. It goes up. And people do point. I mean, it's absolutely astounding that people point to us and say, look, we got it into the archive. I mean, you know, we're an unrefereed resource. What, all it has to be is not, you know, manifestly raving lunacy, and it's in. But so I think it's an excellent idea. We do, you know, in some sense, we're collecting the information passively based on readership, and that's part of what we're feeding back. So that's part of the answer, that we'll have a passive means of doing it, even if we don't have an active system. We do also track the blog track back. Somebody could do sentiment analysis. We don't want to maintain our own discussions. That would be our own discussion forum. But I think the primary reason we'd be hesitant to put the full raw stream out there is just this question of making Cornell look bad that we're sensitive to. And if you're curious to see the raw stream, there's just reverse the spelling of archive and look up vicra.org.
That's what all the crackpots
are. Right.
So is it a question that Paul can answer quickly?
I think one comment that if you start allowing crowdsourcing as a way of determining the availability of rank or ability of the paper to be on archive or how it's promoted, then within 5 years, I bet you'll see a pretty significant fraction of NSF funding going to search engine optimization companies.
So I know some people have a bus to catch, and we have a reception waiting for us out this door. Please join me again in thanking